Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tougher, even if they don't. Today is Thursday, June the 6th, 2024. That means, of course, it is D-Day. I'm not really going to delve off into that. There's plenty of people doing that in mainstream media and what have you. I just will acknowledge the sacrifice that was made on this day and the stark and harsh reality that while there are quite a few World War II veterans left, there's not many. There's just not many. And compared to the number that served and did manage to come home, we are down to a very small minority left. If you think about it, you know, World War II ended in 1945. It's 2024. Some of those guys did lie about their age to get in, but you know, you're talking somebody that was at least 16, 17-ish in 1945. There's just not many people left around that were 16, 17, or older in 1945. And a lot of those guys, you know, today war is really a young man's game. There were a lot of people that ended up leaving their homes either because they were drafted or they volunteered late 20s, mid-30s, even into their 40s in World War II. And it was a really kind of the harshest war that the humans have really ever fought. And I do hope that as many of the stories of these men as possible are being preserved, because we can learn a lot from people who have seen that level of folly in war. Dwight Eisenhower, who went on to be president of the United States, who was a supreme Allied commander, said, "I have seen war in all of its stupidity." And there is a lesson in that, a huge lesson in that. And what this made me think of today when I was kind of reflecting on D-Day was an episode of a TV show called Cheers. Cheers. Remember Cheers? Everybody knows your name. And there's an episode where an old man is sitting at the bar. It's I think it's the first or second season. It's very early in that show. And some of the, you know, the regular cast, the Norm and, you know, Cliff and all start talking to him. And he's waiting for his comrades to come, because they do it every year. They have, you know, have a few drinks together. And it takes them a minute to realize, you know, this is the 80s, right? So we're not that far away from World War II, but a lot of World War II vets were quite elderly at that point. But it takes them a moment to realize, this is a World War I veteran. And when I think about that, there were a significant number of people still alive at that time who had experienced the hell of trench warfare in World War I. And, you know, all of those people are gone now. And it seems to me that we do not take enough lessons from those who actually fight the wars. Instead, we glorify those who instigate, cause, and command men to fight wars. And the soldiers are the ones with the real lessons. And the biggest lesson from the soldier is, by all means possible, avoid this. By all means possible, avoid this. And that wisdom, well, it'll fit right in with our first segment today. It will be from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams. And they're going to talk about how NATO is continuing to recklessly escalate tension with Russia over Ukraine. I could not agree more. And by the way, the reason for that is exactly what I said was going to happen a couple weeks ago is happening. Russia is making significant advancements on the battlefield. They're taking back the few little villages and stuff like that that Ukraine had to show for their offensive. The Ukraine military is completely collapsing. They're upping conscription of women for non-combat roles to free up men for combat. They're sending guys off to the front with almost no training, like 6 weeks of total training, total, all in. Anybody that's ever served in the U.S. military knows that doesn't even cover basic training from 30 years ago. It was 8 weeks. And then even if you were infantry, combat arms, whatever, you know, you had still had an AIT. They called it one station unit where you kind of just kept going. But 6 weeks is just woefully inadequate to prepare somebody for the reality of combat. And it's going to only get worse. And we're going to have to make some decisions there. Dr. Ken Berry will talk about intermittent fasting and how that affects pregnancy. And he's going to have two totally different forms of advice here. People trying to get pregnant and people who have successfully done so. Andy McCann will talk about fitness when you're sick. I have some comments on this one that I don't think Andy makes. I'll re-listen to it before I make my comments to make sure I don't get too redundant there like I do sometimes. But I have a different question for this person in response to their question for the experts. Sean Mills will talk about what to be careful of when talking to solar installation contractors. Most of these companies are employing extremely aggressive, commission-only, kind of sleazy salespeople. And I'll tell you the place you better really stay away from them when you see them at Costco or any place like Sam's Club or whatever like that. Those are the ultimate in like carnival barking salesmen, and they will tell you anything to get you to sign a contract, and they'll make it easy for you to sign a contract. And it doesn't mean because it's easy you should, and Sean will talk about that. Joel Riles will talk about teaching a dog to fetch. I found this one and realized he had sent me two on a single email, and I played the first one, which was on potty training, like months ago. And this one had slipped through the cracks, so I found it. So we're going to talk about fetching. I'll talk a little bit about that, too. Doc Bones will talk about the donation of plasma, blood plasma, not just straight-up blood, and are there any long-term consequences? And this was triggered by the fact that I mentioned I know someone who literally funds their Roth IRA with plasma donations. John Pugliano will talk about a whole bunch of stuff, a lightning round of backlog of questions that he had. And then I actually went out today and I asked you guys on the Telegram group if you had ideas for my segment today. And there were a lot of great ones, but something happened in the interim. I had asked John Bush to send me my talk from Exit and Build, and not the one on compost, because I basically have versions of that. But I was asked to be on a panel for entrepreneurship, and then 10 minutes before we were going to have this panel, I'm just thinking we're going to sit up there on chairs and we're going to answer questions. I said, well, each of you need to talk about entrepreneurship and maybe relate your story to it for about 10 minutes. Okay. So I made a list of four words, and I used those to make this presentation that ended up going about 12 minutes. And I really thought that this would be beneficial to this audience as well. Sometimes when you're put on the spot like that, you do some of your best work. So I'm going to play that for you today. With that, before we get started, let me remind you we're doing a sale for Member Support Brigade this week. You can get MSB and all the discounts and benefits that come with it. It's usually $50 a year. You can get it for $35 a year, and that late rate does lock in unless you cancel your auto-renew. $35 a year basically for life. Discount code, you shouldn't be able to forget this, TSPC. TSPC, just go to the survivalpodcast.com/members or just click on members at the survivalpodcast.com. And up at the top, you'll see a tab that says members, and you can sign up there. And if you want to pay with a check or anything by mail, there's a form for that, and you can write the discount code on it. Yes, I will honor it. And the article that I wrote up on this explains it as well. I'll make sure there's a link to today's show notes for the write-up on the sale as well. And if you want to pay by Bitcoin, then you need to fill out the form. It'll come to me, and we'll work it out behind the scenes. I don't have an automated way to do that. With that, let's drop into Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams here talking about the continuing escalation of just reckless escalation by NATO and the United States with Russia, which is just dumb as hell. Let's hear about that now.
The fundamental aspect of this conflict between Russia and Ukraine is that Russia views it as an existential threat to its existence, having NATO on its borders.
Right.
It views it as an existential threat, whereas Russia's conflict with Ukraine, Russia's invasion, if you will, of Ukraine, is not an existential threat to the United States. It doesn't matter who runs Ukraine fundamentally to the United States. It doesn't matter to the Europeans who runs Ukraine in a fundamental way. So all of this is about an issue that really doesn't matter that much to the U.S. But they say, they started out by saying, well, there's a democracy. If we don't defend democracies, we'll be ruled by tyrants. And then Zelensky canceled elections. He canceled all of the opposition parties. He shut down all the opposition media. He shut down the churches. So they couldn't talk about democracy anymore. So they're looking for other things to do. And they continued to escalate. And that's why it's so important. I put up this first article, and this is a pattern of things that have been going on over the past week. Now, this just happens to be from Zero Hedge. Netherlands joins Denmark in saying Ukraine can use F-16s to strike inside of Russia. So now you have two countries in the EU saying to Ukraine, we're going to give you F-16s, and hey, if you want to go and fight and strike inside of pre-2014 Russia, that's just fine. Well, obviously, that's not going to be very popular with Russia or with its president. Go to the next one. This is from the article. So President Putin has warned of serious consequences after the Kremlin previously warned that NATO bases from which these jets are deployed could come under attack. But on Friday, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg shrugged off Moscow's warnings by saying, this is nothing new. It's been a case for a long time. Every time NATO allies are providing support to Ukraine, President Putin is trying to threaten us to not do it. And an escalation, well, Russia has escalated by invading another country. That's his response. It's no big deal. He's always saying that, he's always complaining, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, you know, there's a serious factor here because these planes are pretty capable of carrying big bombs.
Yeah, nuclear weapons.
Nuclear weapons. And the Dutch foreign minister said, trying to justify this, he said, if you have the right to self-defense, and who doesn't have the right to self-defense? We believe in that. There are, but he said, if you do have the right, there are no borders for the use of weapons. So they can go anywhere they want, and they use the term self-defense, which is just a little bit of lying propaganda is what they're doing to justify this.
Yeah, and even if everything the other side says about what Russia did to Ukraine is true, which is not, but if one day Putin got up and said, you know what, Russia, the largest country on earth, isn't quite large enough, we need to get bigger, so let's invade Ukraine and take it over. Even if that were true, it would still not mean a thing to the United States and certainly would not be risking a nuclear war over. If Russia ran Ukraine, it doesn't matter. It wouldn't matter to the U.S. But do you have these escalations now? You have the, as we talked about before, the saying F-16s can be used to strike inside Russia. Also, apparently, according to Antony Blinken, the Biden White House has lifted restrictions on using weapons, longer-range missiles, on Russian territory, on pre-2014 Russia territory. I don't believe they're going to let them use the ATACMS yet. However, the HIMARS and the others have already been. They've gone into Belgorod yesterday, the U.S. HIMARS. So they're allowing those attacks inside Russia. And go to the next one. And now here's the other escalation. This is a three-part escalation this past week. NATO country sends Air Force instructor to Ukraine ahead of F-16 arrival. So a NATO country, this being the Greeks have sent the first foreign flight instructor deployed to Ukraine. Zero Hedge says this means that for the first time, a NATO instructor has arrived in Kiev as part of preparations to receive F-16s from NATO allies and deploy Ukrainian pilots, the first publicly disclosed instance at least. So now you're seeing, I mean, we talked about, I think you wrote a couple weeks ago about Vietnamization. You're seeing now the trainers are literally now in Kiev. Here's the first.
You know, I'm just going to tell you something in all of this. This would have never happened if the Biden administration didn't effectively greenlight the initial Russian invasion through back channels. If you think back and you stop listening to the TV and you really, really think back to just before this went off, and I said it wouldn't happen, because for the life of me, I could never see what actually went on happening. If you remember, Biden literally said before this started, well, there might be a limited incursion. Do you know why presidents say that? Because their surrogates have talked to the back channel of the opposing force and said, yeah, we're not going to start a war over that if you do it. as I've been saying through this whole thing, the people behind it know the truth. They know the truth that Ukraine cannot win this conflict. And no matter how pissed off you get at me for saying it, I'm only telling you what you know in your heart to be true, and that's why you're angry about it. There is no world in which a nation like Ukraine, no matter how much money and no matter how much weaponry we give them, is going to stand against one of the most advanced, well-armed, and well-trained militaries on the planet. If you want to rank the top three militaries in the world, you can argue about what place they go in, but they're the United States of America, Russia, and China. That's it. I'm sorry. There is no other power on the planet close to the capability of those three, especially with battlefield-level warfare. And so we knew how this would go from the beginning. And as I keep saying, we are either the dumbest dumb people ever, not just dumb, the dumbest of the dumb ever, if we're actually willing to push shit to a World War III status over fucking Ukraine. Or they are playing one of the weirdest games of chicken ever played on the planet, and a very dangerous one at that. And the plan is actually to go ahead and let Ukraine be gutted, and then rebuild it, and then extort it in a form of new colonialism, a.k.a. neo-colonialism, through immigration and degradation of the culture that exists within the country of Ukraine. It's one of the two. And the second one's better than the first, and they're both horrible. And they make the people behind this the dumbest dumb smart people, because they're smart enough to know what they're doing, that have probably ever existed, playing one of the most high-stakes games of chicken ever, and there is no need for this. Again, I heard somebody this last weekend state that not only is Ukraine fighting for their freedom, they're fighting for the freedom of Americans. The fact that anybody would come on your TV and tell you that tells you how stupid they know you are. And when I say you, I don't mean you individually listening to me. When I say you, I mean the American people. We have to have one of the dumbest dumb populations that have ever existed, especially in an age of information like we have today, ever in the history of the world, for anybody having the guts to say something that preposterously stupid. And I've had people get mad at me about this, and I brought that up several times this week. You know what no one's shown me? No one said, well, Jack, you're wrong, and here is how Ukraine is fighting for American freedom. Because you know they're not. This is why people get so mad at me about this. Because you know I'm telling you the truth. And there's nothing that enrages a person like being told the truth that they do not want to hear. What are the five stages of grief? What are the first two? Denial and anger. You get mad at the doctor who tells you that you have cancer. He is not why you have cancer, but you're still mad at him. People get mad at the weatherman because he tells them it's going to rain. Think about that. The reason you get mad at me when I talk about Ukraine is because I'm telling you about the storm, but you're blaming me for it. I'm just analyzing it. Balls and strikes, guys. With that, let's talk about something totally different. Let's talk about fasting and its effect pre-pregnancy and post, I wouldn't say post-fertilization, right? Because like post-pregnancy would be after you have the baby. So before you get pregnant and during pregnancy, how does keto, fasting, all that stuff play in on it? Ken Berry will tell you all about that.
Hey, TSB crew. This is Dr. Ken Berry answering a question today for Emily. Emily says, has two questions. Does intermittent fasting affect your ability to get pregnant? Let's just take that first. So by intermittent fasting, do you mean you're doing a daily intermittent fast, like you're fasting for 16 or 18 hours a day, and then you eat one or two meals? If that's the case, then when you eat, if you're trying to get pregnant, I would say let's eat two meals a day, not one meal a day. And when you do eat your two meals a day in your 4 hour or 6 hour window, you are going to eat until you are comfortably stuffed, Emily. You are not going to portion control or calorie count, calorie reduce, none of that stupid shit. You're going to eat meat and eggs until you cannot eat another bite. This is a signal to your body that there's no famine, that there's plenty of nutrient-dense food everywhere. You're not eating for 18 hours a day, but when you do eat, it's not like you're eating grass and seeds and nutrient-void things. That's what you would be doing in a famine. But in times of plenty, you're going to be eating meat and eggs, and that's what you're eating, and that's going to tell your body it's absolutely fine to get pregnant. Then the second question, can you fast while pregnant? Well, the practical answer is yes. Our ancestors have been doing that for eons, but my advice to you would be don't do much fasting, or not nearly as much fasting as you may be doing currently while you're pregnant, okay? You're not eating for two when you're pregnant. You're eating for about 1.2. That's the actual equation. And so you need to eat till you're comfortably stuffed at least two meals a day while you're pregnant, okay? If you want to keep doing a 16-hour fast while pregnant and eating two good, hearty meals a day, I think that's perfectly fine, perfectly healthy. Try to get some liver in once or twice a week. Try to get some seafood in once or twice a week. And then lots of beef, butter, bacon, and eggs. I'm on keto right now, Emily says, and find it's easy. She's doing a 16 to 18 hour a day. Perfect. Yep. But I wouldn't recommend longer fasts than that while you're trying to get pregnant, and definitely not while you are pregnant. But yes, you can definitely fast while pregnant. Just don't go more than 18 hours. Hope this helps. This is Dr. Barry. Talk to you guys next time.
You know, we recently had a discussion on the show. It might have been last week even, about pregnancy and the issues with nausea early on. I think Bones took that question. And what I would say is I completely agree with Ken's advice, but I would even add to it, once you're pregnant, like, don't go eating like complete and total junk food, like just the worst of the worst, but mostly eat what you want. Try to stay as close to the type of diet that you normally have. But if it comes down between eating something that's maybe not the best, but it's what your craving is pulling, especially like in the first trimester where there's a lot of the nausea, or being so nauseated by the food you normally eat, you can't eat something. Right? Like, the baby needs nutrient, the mom needs nutrient, and we don't want the body in a stress mode during the pregnancy. So things to me get a little bit different during pregnancy, but that does not mean start engulfing massive amounts of seed oil and sugar. I don't think that's a good idea. Moving on, let's talk about something else, like fitness when you're ill, when you're sick. I mean, most of the time you would say, you know, just chill. And maybe that is part of the advice that we'll get here, but this person says it a little bit differently, and I want to go ahead and let Andy answer this question, and then I'm going to come back with kind of a question of my own for the person that asked the original question.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann here in Woodstock, Georgia, and CrossFit Garage. So the question today comes from Rebecca from Tennessee. She said, "What should I do for fitness when I am sick? I have a 2-year-old in daycare, and it seems I'm sick all the time. Help." So hey, this is real. This is you can't get more real life than this. You put your kid in a new environment, all the germs get out there, and they start coming back to you. The reason we do what we do is to become harder to kill. So the answer to your question is going to depend on, man, some of your reasons and what's coming up. If you have an issue with, actually, let's go with this first. If you are super sick, like, hey, I have the flu and I'm achy and I can't do anything, realize that sometimes the best medicine is to take care of yourself, right? So rest, relax, and make plans for when you feel better. Now, if it's not something that's totally taking you out, there is some medicine in movement. How much movement then becomes a question. I'm going to speak from personal experience and what I've done throughout my 18 years of CrossFit. If I get super sick, now if I'm coughing and spreading germs, I usually don't go anywhere. I'll just stay home and do something. If I'm just not feeling great, then I'll just move off to the side on my own and I will do something. And typically that something is just the warm up, or maybe hop on a rower or a bike and just move. I have found for my own self that, again, movement can be the medicine that I need. I think what you need to remember is it's a journey, and sometimes there are bumps along the road. Now, I'm getting from this that you're saying you're continually sick. So I have a 2-year in daycare and I'm sick all the time, meaning I get better, I get sick, I get better. It's like a back and forth. So maybe that's the new reality, and what do I need to do? I wouldn't give up on fitness. You're in this for the long haul. You're going to invest in yourself all the time. Look at it like the market, like stocks or gold or Bitcoin. Do you buy high? I mean, the answer should be yes, you buy all the time. Do you buy low? Yes, right? Sometimes when it's low and you've watched it for this long and you know it's low, you buy more. So double down when it's lower? Possibly. If you know it's going up, then yeah, double down, buy up or buy as it's going up. So what I would throw out there is it depends. Let's say, for example, you get sick. You know you have a race in 2 weeks. Well, then I would focus on getting better. I would do everything that your mom told you to do when you were growing up, right? So make sure you get better. Get lots of sleep. Get lots of fluid. Do all that normal stuff. Dr. Bones can tell you all that. I would say don't worry so much about the fitness. Get so that you can actually go do whatever the race is that or the event that's coming up. Okay, so let's go with there's no event. It's just natural life, and I feel like I'm losing out by not doing anything. All right, so we use fitness as a hedge or protection against sickness. And let me back that up. If you go to the doctor and your heart rate is at rest, is 150, we could all make a pretty good prediction that, hey, you're not very healthy. Something is wrong with you. 150 is not great. Okay, now, if you go to the doctor and you're super sick and they do your heart rate and they're like, hey, you're at 150. Well, they're going to be, yeah, of course, because you're sick. Now, let's say you're healthy and fit. You've been doing this journey for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years. Your resting heart rate is spectacular. Let's just go with it's 50 beats per minute. Okay, so you get sick. You're going to move from a fit through this continuum. Imagine a rainbow and you're going across this rainbow or the arc. So on the right side, you have fit and healthy, right? And then you go to the middle portion, which is just healthy. So a healthy heartbeat would be, you know, like maybe 70, 80 beats per minute. So if you're at 50 and you get sick and it drops you to 70 or 80, your markers are, I'm actually just at the same place that everybody else is. Your body is harder to kill. You're going to have a better time fighting things off if you've given yourself this health and fitness. So you could be stacking all of this, I will get better, into the times when you get sick. So when you're feeling good, yeah, let's make sure we hit every day. Let's plan our schedule. If you know, I guess, you know, I would add this too. If you know, hey, every month I get sick and then I'm good for a month and then I get sick. So I would edit my schedule and say, instead of doing 5 days a week of training or 3 days or whatever you've got, I would put it in there for every day. And if you're feeling like, oh, I've worked out too much, I don't have anything left in the tank, then just make it a long walk, right? Make it an active recovery, but do every day so that when you get sick, you've stacked up some extras. Now, there is some diminishing returns to just doing 7 days a week of working out. Your body does need rest. This is trying to get on top of, if I know I'm going to have down days, because when I get sick for my kid, it's like flu and I'm out, then yeah, don't do anything. Now, on the flip side, as you're getting better, you could find movement is the medicine. So again, what I do is something simple just to get myself warm, get my body movement. I like full body movements. That's one of the reasons I really like CrossFit. It's constantly varied functional movement. So I'm going to stand up, sit down. You could throw a burpee in there. You could do some squats. You can do a whole bunch of stuff at home. It doesn't have to be complicated. If you're the type of person who says, if I get off of track, that if I get my habits out of whack, I have a hard time getting back on that habit train, then I would still mark that time and do something else with that time. So let's say, I don't know, you typically work out at 8 a.m. Then I would still block out that time. And if I can't work out, I would still put on my workout gear or have it near me. And then I would read a book, listen to a podcast, something so that time is still blocked so you don't lose the habit of doing it. That's something that I see happen to a lot of people, not with a sickness, but a physical injury. Hey, I hurt my foot, my shoulder, my whatever. And they stop their routine and they could hardly ever get it going once whatever it is feels better. Or they say, hey, when my arm feels better, I'll get back to it. They never do. So stick to the routine. All right. If you have specific questions on that, you can hit me at andy@crossfitgarage.com. You can also follow me on all the socials. I have a podcast called crossfitgarage.com because it's unoriginal. And I'm here to help you guys with your health and fitness needs.
So some of you know that the question that I'm going to put back is, what do you mean you're always sick? This is not normal. I'm not going to talk around it like Andy did or whatever, or acknowledge it as normal. It is not normal to always be sick. Something else is going on if you are quote-unquote always sick, or you're overstating it. It's one or the other. So if you mean by always sick, you know, a couple, three times a year, you pick up some kind of a bug that is transmitted home from one snot slinger to another, okay. And you're just overstating it, then just do what Andy said. Okay. If you mean always sick is in a couple times a month that you're having something that's actually impairing your ability to function, then I have to ask you, what are the practices in your life that are leading to that? There are purists that say stupid shit like healthy people don't get sick. If you're truly healthy on well-balanced nutrition and whatever, it doesn't matter what you're exposed to, you'll never get sick. This is what you would call classic, you know, terrain theory versus germ theory here. And I don't buy that. I think a person can be in incredible health, and if they're exposed heavily enough to the right pathogen, they're going to become sick. But this idea that you know, people that have kids are just going to be always sick too is a little bit fanciful if that person is otherwise a healthy person with a strong immunity built up. Because a lot of the diseases and little things your kids are sliding around on the floor with snot and putting things in their mouth and passing to each other, you've already had at least variants of those diseases and your kids haven't, and that's why they get sick more as they build up their immunity. And you should have a greater innate immunity against all of these things than they do, especially at the prime of your existence. So I'm going to suggest that you really evaluate what kind of diet you're on and what kind of mineral deficiencies that you have. You may want to talk to Dr. Stephen Lewis over at Green Wisdom Health and have a panel done on your actual nutrient levels of all of the major macro and micro, or all the micronutrients and vitamins and things that you're supposed to have. What is your vitamin D level? Do you even know? Like, the first thing I would tell this person is to get a vitamin D level test. And if it tells you it's normal and not to worry about it because it's like a 30, then it's too low. It's too low. So I'm not just going to say go out and start taking a bunch of vitamin D, even though it's a pretty harmless thing to actually do, and a bunch is a lot more than you think it is. But I would really start to evaluate your own personal health if you mean it when you say always sick. And then the other thing I'm going to say is they're sick and then they're sick. And what I mean by that is there's my nose is stuffed up and I don't really feel good and go do a workout. You'll actually recover faster. And there is sick like I was like 2 weeks ago, whatever the hell crap I picked up down in Bastrop. Right? That was a complete, you know, non-normal thing for me to be that sick. Like, I haven't been that sick forever. Now, if you're getting sick to that kind of level where you really are impaired in your ability to do things, again, all the time, to me means very frequently, every couple, 3 weeks, you need to look at your lifestyle itself. If, again, if it's, well, I feel kind of stuffy and a little bit in the head cloud, but overall I can do my job, then you can get on an exercise bike. You can take a walk. You can do all the things. And I have found that when I get like that little bit of like a thing going on, the more physically I work, the faster I get rid of it. It's like you push it out of your body. You key up your immune system. You're telling your body, we have things to do. This inconvenience needs to go. And then I would also say, just to hedge all of this in, like, again, I don't think it is normal for anybody, I don't care how many kids you're around, to always be sick. You may want to have like a complete workup done just to be sure there's not some other problem there, that it's not just like a nutritional deficiency or a vitamin D deficiency. To be fair, that there's not something else going on. So you might want to have like a full panel done just for that as well. Because, again, it depends on what you mean. Some people say always and they mean three times a year. Some people say always and they mean every couple of weeks. And those are very, very different. So temper my more aggressive stance on this with that acknowledgement. Now, let's talk about people I have no temperance for. I have no patience for. Overly aggressive salespeople in the solar industry. And Sean Mills will talk about that.
Hey guys, it's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead, and today I've got a question about what to watch out for when you're talking to a solar provider or installation company. I'm going to keep this one anonymous, so the guy that actually reached out to Jack, he also reached out to me directly and then hired me to evaluate his system and poke a bunch of holes in it. So I don't want to give out too much personal information that could be identifying. So we'll just say this person is in Southeast Texas. He filled out a form online and got two different quotes on, you know, an installation with all the equipment and warranties and all that stuff. He said he was kind of scared by how aggressive they were acting when he initially filled the form out. He was bombarded with calls and texts wanting information. So, number one, what I would say is, if you're looking to install one of these systems, do not go fill out a form online. Call a local company that does solar and have them send someone to your house to evaluate your actual system and give you a real quote based on your actual information. All right. That's number one. If you go fill out a form, all you're doing is you're having that company reach out to all of the people in your area that have signed up to pay them for leads. And then those companies, which are utilizing unpaid, not unpaid, but commission only third party salespeople, all those salespeople are going to reach out to you at the same time, trying to lock you into their system before you've got a chance to figure out whether or not it's going to make money for you or not. Okay. So that's number one. Don't use the online form. Go find a local company. If the local company isn't willing to send someone to your house to actually evaluate the system and provide you with a real quote, then they're not worth dealing with. And I know that there's a lot of companies out there that are going to say things like, well, if we had people to go out and respond to every single person that's interested in solar, then we'd spend all our time quoting jobs and no time actually doing it. And I understand that. But you've got to be able to find the ones that are not paying a third-party company for leads, paying another third-party salesperson to close the deal. Then they're paying a third-party subcontractor to do the work. They're buying substandard components and installing them into the system and then charging you 100% markup. Or, here's the other side, using the most expensive components that they can possibly find to put into the system that are backed by really, really strong warranties, and then telling you, hey, one of the things that we do that the other companies don't do is we provide warranty support. There's all these problems that people are having with systems that get installed, and then they have a problem 6 months later, and there's no one around to come do the actual warranty claim. So what these guys are doing is they're buying Tesla Powerwalls and Mission Solar panels, right? Big, large, American-based companies that have kind of rock-solid warranties. And then if there's a problem, of course they're not charging you for a warranty call. They're charging the other company, you know, charging the solar company, or they're charging Tesla for their Powerwall for the actual warranty claim. That's how they're getting around this. They're either using substandard components and marking them up 100 or 200%, or they're using really, really good components and then utilizing the fact that there's not going to be a warranty claim that you have to pay for as part of their, you know, sales product. So that's number one, find a local company. Number two, assume that everything they tell you in their 5 to 10 page sales brochure that they send you is wrong. Okay. I'm not going to go into a ton of the details here, but I will share with you the actual numbers from the system that I reviewed with this listener. Okay. So basically what they were telling him is, we're going to have a system that's going to pay for itself. It's going to zero out your power bill, and over the life of the system, it's going to save you like $50,000. You're going to spend $50,000 on the system, and then it's going to save you all this money. Now, how could they possibly say that? Well, one of the things that they're doing is they're using a 4% compound interest rate to determine, you know, inflation to the actual power bill itself. So they're saying that, yeah, next year you're going to reduce $1,200 worth of bill, but in 2050, that's going to be like $3,500. Okay, so they're using that annualized compounding inflation rate on the bill to justify the massive cost of the system. Now, for this system, they were going to charge him, it was $50,900 for the system. They were going to give him a $3,000 rebate. Okay, so they're getting that $3,000 rebate from the manufacturers, and they're just passing that through to the actual homeowner. And then, of course, he's going to get the 30% tax credit on his $48,000. We'll just round it up to $48,000 out-of-pocket expense. Okay, that $48,000 pocket out-of-pocket expense at a 3.99% interest rate. I'm not sure whether they're using that. There aren't any more 3.99% interest rate loans on something like a solar system, but that's what they were using. That would actually cost the homeowner $75,921 over that 25-year loan, okay? Now, if he took the entire amount of the solar tax credit that he got about 16 months in and applied it to the loan balance, then he would only pay about $56,000, right? So that would be, he would reduce the amount of interest that he paid by generally $20,000 over the cost of the loan. if he paid that $14,000 tax credit as soon as he got it. So as soon as he got it back from the government, he just applied it to the principal balance of the loan. Then he would shave a bunch of years off and a bunch of interest off. So then we look at, okay, well, how much is the system actually going to produce? And these are real numbers from the review that we did. Well, over that 25-year period, the system's going to produce $51,462.50 worth of electricity. Well, wait a minute. They told us we were going to save all this money and it was going to zero our bill out. Well, the problem is they say we're going to generate 100% of the cost of your electricity, right? So if you use 1,000 kilowatt hours on average per month and the system generates 1,000 kilowatt hours on average per month, that's 100%. But they ignore all the things that aren't the kilowatt hour that go into your bill, like the $20 fee that you pay every month just for being attached to the grid. And I got news for you. Those 4% cost of that are going to increase every year on average, those are not going to be the kilowatt hour cost. Those are going to be the connection cost, which are not eligible to be zeroed out with generation. So not only do they make the mistake of using an incorrect loan rate, they also utilize the entire bill as if the only thing on the bill is the kilowatt hour rate. Then they mark that up 4% per year forever to justify the massive cost of the system. His quote was about 70% higher than the average for North America, which includes all the inflated California solar rooftop installations. We figured it's going to be about 100% markup for profit and overhead for the company based on what the component costs actually were and what it costs to hire a subcontractor to do the installation. So all I would say again is find a local company, and then as soon as you get that quote, assume everything in there is a lie and then go try to prove that it's all a lie. And some of those things you'll find are actual lies. If you want me to review a system like that for you, just go to hackmyhomestead.com. There's a troubleshooting link for you to fill out a little form. And I can actually do that at my consultation rate. So just as a data point, it costs this customer $200 to do this review for me or with me, and it saved him $50,000 plus the $24,000 in the hole he would have been in after 24 years, even if he didn't have to replace any of the components in the system, which much likely he would have. So I know I went a bit long with that today, but I just wanted to give you guys a full view of what you can expect if you go fill one of those forms out online and hire one of those companies based on their quote that they send to you. With that being said, keep getting quotes in the jack, and I'll keep getting them. I'm sorry, keep getting questions in the jack, and I'll keep getting them answered. Thanks, guys.
I despise these people. I despise these people, and I will tell you, most of the people that are salespeople for them, they're people that answered like the equivalent of a modern version of a newspaper ad in the 1980s. No experience required. We'll train you. They don't know anything. They're not even really lying. They're just ignorant. They believe what their company tells them. They hire high energy people that are relatively decent looking people, that are trustworthy looking people, and they give them this shit in a book and they say, go sell this, and if you don't sell it, you're going to starve. And when you do that to people, their entire mentality changes. One of two things happens when you put a person into that position. Well, three. A huge portion of them, no matter how hard they try, no matter how willing they are to bend, to follow a procedure, whatever, they're just not going to be able to pull it off, and they're going to wash out and go do something else, like, I don't know, bus tables at Denny's, until they find something else to do. Then there's a portion of them that are intelligent and will begin to listen to the pushback that they get, and they will realize that they are working for a completely unethical company, and they will quit and go do something else. And then there are the ones that will make a lot of money doing it. They will sell their soul. They do not care that they're lying to people. It's not their problem. All they have to do is get the signature on the contract, and they will do it for as long as it works, and then they will go do that somewhere else. And if you're talking to somebody that flags you down at a Costco, it's inevitable that you're talking to one of those people who has done well enough that they have given him that type of an opportunity. These people don't care about you, and they lie. And when they succeed, it never benefits the customer. I'll give you an example. And this is quite a few years back. My son was looking to buy a house, and the house had a basically a 25-year lease solar system on it that was about 3 years into the lease. And it was transferable to the new homeowner, and they had this additional payment on it. And we looked at it, and he was excited because the real estate agent told him, you know, this is going to save you a lot of money on your electric bill. But the lease payment on the equipment exceeded by about 5x what the savings on the electric bill were. And that was based on a non-conservative best-case math problem that I did with my son. Here's how much that this can possibly produce in the best-case scenario. And here's the lowest you're going to pay per kilowatt, right? We did the exact opposite of what they did. We made it benefit actually, we did exactly what they did. We made it benefit them. The solar panel people, and there was no ROI on it. There was no, you would never, you 20 years to break even. 20 years to break even. 20 years. I'm like, you won't own this house for 20 years. You'll never, this is bad. Do not do this. This is why this house, and it was at a time when houses were selling really, really fast. I'm like, this is why this house isn't selling, because anybody can do math knows not to buy it. He got a little bit frustrated with me because they were getting into that crunch where they felt the pressure. I'm like, this is where you need to not make a decision. When you feel pressure to get something bought, you need to be patient. There's always deals, and this isn't one of them. I despise salespeople like this. I despise them. They are at the same level of the person that comes to your house when you're 25 years old and writes you a whole life policy for $1 million and tells you it's a way to save money. What you really need to be doing is paying somebody like Sean a very small amount of money relative to what you're going to spend to design a system that's optimum for your needs, and then shopping around the installation of the parts of it you can't do. And this won't save you hundreds of dollars or even thousands. This will save you tens of thousands of dollars. And I don't believe, you know, if I can make a single phone call and get something done for $20,000 that I want done, and if I did a bunch of legwork myself and it would cost me like $18,000 and it saves me $2,000, my time's pretty valuable. I'm probably willing to pay that $2,000 premium, but I don't pay premiums in decades of thousands, right? Tens of thousands. I don't do that. And I don't think you should either. And if you trust these people, it'll actually be worse. I believe that the average person who trusts these people will spend at least double what they should relative to what they will get. At least double. Just my opinion. Now, let's talk about teaching a doggo to play fetch.
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Canine Academy coming back to answer another question for you on the Expert Council. And it's actually a bonus question from Chris in Kentucky, who asked the question last time about potty training a 10-month-old Labrador. And his question was, how to teach a dog to fetch. So I was going to go through that with you guys today briefly and kind of show you how we do that with our dogs. So the very first thing that we want to do is find an object that the dog is already interested in. Now, a lot of times this is a ball, but if your dog seems uninterested in a ball, you can initially start this with something more like a soft play toy or something like that. And I'll kind of shake it in front of them, and I'll kind of act interested in it, like, oh, what is that? And I'll kind of pick it up, and I'll toss it a little bit. And oftentimes I'm on my hands and knees on the ground with a young dog when I'm doing this, or out in the grass while I'm doing this. And you can do it with a ball or any other soft toy, but you're trying to get the dog interested in putting its mouth on the object. Now, once it starts to put its mouth on the object, I want to praise the dog with something like good fetch or good get it. We typically use get it instead of fetch. And then as soon as they get it, I want to try and encourage them to hold it in their mouth, and I tell them bring it. So I use get it to go and get the object and then bring it to bring it back to me. And since I'm already pretty close to the dog, unless they get real excited and just run off with it, which they will occasionally do, I will just say, oh, good, get it. And they're kind of right there next to me already. And I'll reach over and grab like a flat collar, or I'll just pull them over close to me. I'll praise them up, good, get it. And then when I reach down and put my hand on the object, I'll tell them, good, bring it, attaboy, good, bring it. Now, if they don't release it for me, I want to make sure they've had adequate praise before I do this, and then I will tell them out. And out means let go of it with your mouth, right? Stop holding on to it. And if I need to, I'll reach in and gently kind of reach under their lips, their upper lips, and squeeze their back teeth just a little bit to get them to open their mouth. And then as soon as I have it in my hand, I praise more. Oh, good out. Attaboy, good out. And then I'll start immediately playing with it again, kind of tossing it back and forth. They'll get excited. They'll jump and put their teeth on it. Good, get it. And then bring it. And then I slowly continue this process by I'm tossing it a little farther out each time. Now, what will often happen when you do this is you'll reach a certain distance where they get it and they want to run around and they don't want to bring it back to you. This is one of the reasons why the praise is really important, and I also don't necessarily want to take it away from them immediately necessarily. Now, there are times and places when that is important for certain training things that we do, but if they're losing interest because I'm taking it too quickly, I'll let them kind of continue to play with it. If I'm using something like a soft toy, often what I'll do is I'll grab a part of it and kind of play a little tug game with them, right? And I'm praising them the whole time I'm doing this. Good, get it. Good, get it. Oh, yeah. And I'm kind of pulling and tugging a little bit, and they're pulling back. And I just encourage that behavior. And I'll do it for 5 to 15 seconds, and then I'll stop my motion. I'll stop moving so that I'm not continuing to encourage the tugging. And I'll say, okay, good, bring it. Now, out. And then I'll, again, reach in under their lips, squeeze their teeth just a little bit to open their jaw, take it out of their mouth, and then praise them, good out, good out. And we'll go back and forth with this process until the dog is, every time I throw the object, they run out and get it, and I say, good, get it. And then when I tell them bring it, they bring it back to me, and then they out when I tell them to out. Now, some of the dogs will run out and get it, and then when I say bring it, they'll either run around and not want to come back, or they'll drop it, right? So if they run around and don't want to come back, I'll attach a long line to their flat collar because I don't want to associate correction with this unless I have to. And I'll just gently pull them toward me with the flat collar and the long line while I'm praising them for getting it and bringing it. So it'll be something like, good, get it, good, bring it, good, bring it. If they drop it, I usually start by, it's okay, get it. And they'll pick it back up, and I go, good, get it. If they don't pick it up, I start to play with it again until they pick it up, and then I praise them for getting it again, right? So depending on how sensitive your dog is to some of this stuff, you may have to play with some of these things back and forth a little bit. But ultimately, what I'm looking for in the end is I throw the object, I tell them to go get the object, they get it, I praise them, good, get it, bring it. When they bring it to me, I praise them, good, bring it. And then once they're back with me, I put my hands on the object that's in their mouth and I say out and they give it to me. It's really important when you're doing this because you want it to be enjoyable and a game for the dog that there's lots and lots of praise, both verbally as well as petting praise when they do this. Now, sometimes they'll bring it right back and they'll drop it on the ground at my feet. I don't typically mind that unless there's a reason you don't want them doing that. That's fully acceptable. But certainly when you put your mouth or your hand on it while it's in their mouth and you want them to release it, you want to make sure that they know the out command. So now if they're refusing, if you're trying to squeeze their mouth to have them release it and they're refusing, I'll grab the lead on a prong collar or some kind of correction collar and I do a light correction and I'll say, fooey that out, right? So my fooey is our verbal correction command, but I'm giving it very gently. I'm not going fooey that. I'm just fooey it out. And then I might have to pop a little harder on the correction until they release it, but I want it to be as gentle as possible and get the release. And then I immediately praise them for out. Good out, good out. All right, guys, I hope this has been helpful for you. I hope you enjoy working with your dogs on teaching them fetch. Don't forget, if you want lots of other dog training, you can find that at canineacademy.us. I highly recommend you use the link at Jack Spierko's website, The Survival Podcast. Click on the banner and hop on over and check us out. We would love to work with you and help teach you how to train your dogs. Until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
I don't do much of anything different except a couple things, and this is like personal preference and things. So one thing Joel never does is use food and training. And his reasoning for it is solid. His reasoning is, I may have the dog in a situation, I need compliance, and I may not have food. So I use the tools that will always be with me, which is correction and a collar, right? Because they're always there. And so I get that. But I have found that food is a valid training tool. And the big thing that I will say, though, is if you're using food as a training tool, don't always give the food reward. You can condition the response using the food, and then you can go to the point where maybe every time the dog does what you want, not necessarily going to get a food reward, but maybe it gets one every fifth or sixth time. And dogs can count to like three. I mean, seriously, the average adult dog, so 2.5, 3 years old, can count to around 3 to 4. So you may not want to do the same amount, like so it becomes a pattern, because dogs will figure patterns out better than you would think they would. My other thing is, and you do have to be careful with this, and I do some things with dogs that if you have a dog that's not a pup, that you may not want to ever do with that dog because you didn't begin the behavior when they were a pup. So one of my correction methods with dogs, especially when they display aggression, is I will put a dog to the ground like another dog will to require submission. So by the and this is not what I would do here. I'm just giving an example. This is something you really do not want to do unless you have experience with it, unless you've conditioned the dog from a pup this way, because you can lose your hand this way. Right, but even my very aggressive dogs, larger dogs that I've had, pits, pit mixes, lab chow mix. So labs we think of as being fairly docile, but chows are not. I had a Rottweiler when I was a kid that I did this with, down to the ground. Like if you have a 5-year-old dog that's never had you do that, and you do that, that can backfire. All right, what I'm about to tell you could also backfire, except that I do this from the time I'm dealing with a pup, and that is where he talks about squeezing the jaw. What I will do is go behind the thing the dog has in its mouth with my thumb and my hand, like on the bottom of the outside bottom of the jaw. The thumb goes in the mouth, on the tongue, in the back of the throat, pushed down like a tongue depressor from a doctor. And you know, he has his out command. I use drop it. Drop it. So whatever command you use, drop it. And if you do that when they're pups, that command becomes very effective, because the Pavlovian response, like you ring the bell, the dog slobbers because it knows it's about to get fed, right? Its mouth salivates. It's the same type of thing. Like now when I say drop it means I'm going to, right? So I need to get rid of this thing. And it tends to be pretty effective. And I have had a lot of issues with dogs that will go out and get the thing and then like drop it and come back to you. And that does take some effort. I've also seen dogs like get this right away. Like his very young pups, like you just play with them in the house and you're not throwing it very far, and they get it and they bring it right back and you pet them, and like they're just on it, and you're like, man, this dog just knows. And then they decide, I don't really want to do that anymore. And so the lesson in that is that it's not always about teaching the dog, but about training the dog that you expect compliance, right? Because the dog that does that, well, clearly knows what to do, right? You're not in a what to do scenario with that dog anymore. You're in, I'm requiring this of you. And that takes patience, right, to get the dog. But you can't shortcut the dog deciding, I will obey the master. That is something you have to build a relationship and train. And remember, training and teaching are different. Training and teaching are different. Teaching means you can go out and do a thing. Training means you respond a certain way. I can train a slime mold. I can train a tree, right? I can't teach a tree. But I can teach a dog and I can train a dog. Like, I have trained my dogs, to do a lot of things with commands, but I've also taught them that if you find an egg that's not in the coop, you're welcome to have it. Because I would rather them find it laying around somewhere and eat it than it attract predators or it rot. And so, like, they needed to understand how an egg works. A dog generally doesn't know how an egg works. Like they, it's hard. It's not something they're accustomed to. They're not a wild animal. They didn't grow up with a mama dog teaching them, right? They did. Like a coyote pup will learn from a coyote mother. Like if she finds eggs, she'll literally bring it back to them and put it in front of them whole and show them how. So when you show a dog, hey, this breaks, it's a danger, because now they know they can go in the coop and get more of those delicious little nuggets. But that's because they're taught, so they'll go do a thing without you. Right? And it's not necessarily a compliance thing at that point. The dog knows now this thing has good stuff in it. That's teaching, that's not training. And so there's a balance with dogs. Most of your effort goes toward training, but some of it does go toward teaching. Anyway, with that, let's go on and talk about our next one. We have a question for donating blood plasma for Doc Bones.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning 4th edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. This week's question for the expert counsel comes from Dan from Indiana, who writes, are there any long-term consequences of donating, selling plasma regularly? On a recent episode, Jack mentioned someone making enough money selling plasma to max out an IRA annually. Are there any health issues that one can have long-term from donating that frequently? Thanks, Dan from Indiana. Dan, blood drives occur in every municipality to help with the need for the life-giving fluid in local hospitals. You specifically mentioned plasma donation, so I'm guessing you're not talking about giving blood in general, which are different things. Whole blood contains solid components like microscopic red blood cells, white blood cells, and clotting factors like platelets. Plasma is itself the yellowish fluid in which they all float and is a source of antibodies and other substances. It's the red cells that make blood red. Separating whole blood into its various components is done by a process called apheresis. When you just donate plasma, you get back the rest of the components. I guess I should mention some basics about blood types. There are four major blood types determined by the presence or absence of two substances called antigens, known as A and B. And these are on the surface of red blood cells. In addition to the A and B antigens, there is a protein on the red blood cells called the Rh factor, which can be either present, which is characterized by a plus sign, or absent, and negative, which is characterized by a negative sign or a minus sign. And that creates the eight most common blood types: A positive, A negative, B positive, B negative, O positive, O negative, AB positive, and AB negative. Suffice it to say, the type O negative is thought to be a universal blood donor, while type AB is considered to be a universal plasma donor. There's a difference, and we're not going to go into that in this segment. While you can donate whole blood only about every 8 weeks, maximum 6 times a year, you can donate plasma up to twice a week in many places, although the Red Cross only allows it every 28 days. Expect about $50 to $100 for a plasma donation, depending on the blood type. So in areas that allow you to donate over 100 times a year, well, as Jack said, that adds up to a pretty penny. Plasma is in high demand, especially in certain blood types, as it helps to treat a number of health issues like blood clotting disorders, certain neurological conditions, immune support, and to use antibodies to fight infection, and even more things than that. Plasma donation is a relatively safe procedure, but there can be minor side effects to your question. These include feeling lightheaded or dizzy, minor bleeding, bruising, and inflammation around the donation site. Occasionally, a reaction may occur to the antiseptic used to clean the skin, like betadine. These aren't too unusual. Sometimes they'll stop the donation process if the donor faints or becomes nauseous, vomits, drops their blood pressure, or becomes pale and clammy. That does occur. In these cases, you need to rest with your feet raised above the level of the heart until you feel better. Usually, people are given fluids or a snack if they're awake and alert to speed that along. There are some complications that you might see in very rare instances. One is an infection that develops at the IV site. That's called cellulitis. It's characterized by swelling, pain, a spreading redness, and warmth in the area. This may require antibiotics to treat. Now, rarely, blood cells may be damaged during the donation procedure and leak a protein called hemoglobin into the plasma. That's something called hemolysis. If it's severe, blood may even be seen in the urine. That can be a serious issue. Also, rarely, something called an air embolism may develop. That's the bubble that enters through the IV and can travel to the brain or lungs and be life-threatening. Okay, listen, Dan, now that I've scared you silly, remember that these are very rare complications, even if you donate 100 times a year. Most people who donate plasma have no problem whatsoever as long as they're well hydrated and stop taking aspirin or other blood thinners 48 hours beforehand. Get a good night's sleep, too. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn about important off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, The Essential Guide for When Help Is Not on the Way. And get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
All right, and next up after that, we have a lightning round of backlog questions from John Pugliano.
Hello, TSP. Well, hey, I've got a big backlog of questions to answer. I'm going to try and jump in right now and get all these answered. So they're going to be short and sweet answers. If you feel you need a more detailed answer to your question, feel free to reach out to me and we can talk about your personal situation. But in any case, here we go. First two questions are from Richard, and his first question is easier to answer than his second, so let's start on that. He says, can a securities-backed line of credit replace an emergency fund? Okay, right here, Richard, I'm going to say that I depart from guys like Dave Ramsey that are super dogmatic about things. I think there's a lot of gray area in most things in life, and things like debt and emergency funds are no different. Specifically to your question about emergency funds, well, you know what? I don't have an emergency fund. Now, I used to have an emergency fund, but I got to the point in my life where I was financially independent enough where I didn't have to keep money in reserve to pay for unexpected expenses because I got to the point where I had enough wealth where I could just draw from my assets and I could deploy my assets in such a way that either by investing them or having them in some type of an income-earning instrument, I was going to make a lot more by having them invested than I would just having them sitting in a bank account somewhere. So I don't have an emergency fund. I don't think everybody needs one if you have assets that you can quickly draw upon should you need the money in case of an emergency. Now, specific to your question, would it be all right to use a security-backed line of credit, meaning that you have your emergency fund money tied up in something like the stock market where you own good quality growth and income type stocks and equities? And should an emergency occur, maybe you don't want to sell those assets right away. In the example you give, you mentioned that, you know, maybe the stock market's down and you don't want to have to sell at a loss or at a lower value. And so you could borrow against those assets using a securities line of credit. Well, I'll give you an even better example of the one that you gave, and that would be to avoid a short-term capital gains tax. Let's say that you have a really large short-term capital gain. And if you just wait, say, 2 or 3 months, it would turn into a long-term capital gain, and that could substantially reduce the amount of taxes you'd have to pay. So something like that would clearly be a reason when I think it could be considered that you'd use some type of credit against your assets. But having said that, I would still, in general, discourage people from doing these kind of things because debt not only comes with added costs, it also comes with added risk. You know, in the example you gave, you can easily plug some numbers into a spreadsheet, determine how much you're going to pay in interest and transaction fees, and if that would offset either the loss you have to sell at or the increased taxes you'd have to pay by, you know, taking a capital gains tax, yeah, that can all be calculated. But remember, there is a fee for what you're doing. There's a cost to it in physical dollars, and then also in the terms of risk. You know, you mentioned deferring selling in a down market. Well, you know, things could always get worse, too. So that could snowball and compound your situation. And not so much in the example you gave, but in general, you'll hear a lot of people talking about borrowing from their 401k. Well, that all sounds well and good, but a lot of people don't realize that if you lose your job, whether you quit or get fired, you are required by law to pay that 401k loan back within 90 days of your termination date. So imagine that you borrow from your 401k because you have an emergency, and then you end up losing your job and getting fired before you pay it back. Now you still not only have that debt, but if you don't pay that money back right away, you also get hit with taxes and penalties. And so always keep that in mind. Now, Richard's next question is much more complicated, and I'm not going to really give you a good answer here, Richard. And actually, this is going to tie in with the next question as well. Now, Richard's question is about survivorship planning, where when you die and you leave your assets to someone like a spouse or a family member that is likely to not be making good investment choices, especially, you know, during that time when they're suffering from bereavement and grief. Richard, there's really no good answer here because no matter what you put in place, if there's enough money and if there's enough willpower, the beneficiary can find a way to unwind whatever you've done or to just take it and make really lousy financial decisions with it. So it's really all about educating and trying to help that person now while you're still alive. And if you can't, then potentially there are things that can be done with restrictive trusts or protective annuities. But again, the bottom line is those things come at a cost. And if the beneficiary is determined enough to make poor financial decisions, then they will still find a way to make poor financial decisions. And that segues into Cameron's question. He has an aunt, she's turning 80, and she has asked him to sit down with her and to review her finances. As you mentioned in your question, you really don't know what you're going to find out, and so I wouldn't go in with any preconceived ideas. She's 80 years old. It sounds like overall she's actually probably doing pretty well for her age and her situation. And I really think at her age, and particularly since she's now a widow, what she may need more than portfolio management or investment is advice. is more along the lines of estate planning and looking at the areas where, as she comes to the end of her life, she's going to be most vulnerable. And those are going to be things like long-term care, should she be unable to take care for herself. And then also, elderly people are very vulnerable to fraud and investment schemes and other types of ripoffs. At her age and without any direct children or grandchildren, before you jump in and start making tweaks to her portfolio or investment strategy, I'd focus on making sure the basics are in place. Things like having a medical power of attorney and a legal structure in place to take care of her should she become incapacitated or mentally incompetent to take care of herself. Okay, running out of time here real quick. Last two questions. Lewis asks about the increasing fees that Vanguard is charging. Hey, you know, I wouldn't get all wrapped up about those. The list of things that you sent me, things like a $100 closing fee to close out a retirement account, those are all pretty standard. You know, I have to understand that discount brokers like Charles Schwab or low-cost investment companies like Vanguard, and as they've done away with most or all of the typical trading transaction fees, they've got to get their money from somewhere. And if anything, it really comes back to what I always talk about with understanding the difference between being an investor and being a saver. Listen, if you have a $1,000 retirement fund and they charge you $100 to close it out and transfer it somewhere else, yeah, that's an outrageous fee. But you shouldn't only have $1,000 in your retirement account to begin with. If you have $1,000, that's not investing, that's saving. And if you know the distinction between what is saving and what is investing, then you'll save yourself from paying a lot of these hidden fees. Okay, last question comes from Troy. And real quick, he says, would you recommend mobile wireless providers such as AT&T and Verizon for dividend-producing stocks as a method of creating cash flow? Well, Troy, full disclosure here, I own Verizon. In my opinion, both of those stocks are value traps. Yes, they appear to have a reasonable price-per-earnings ratio, and yes, they do pay substantially high dividends. The problem is that these are old, stodgy companies that just don't have any growth, and they've had their lunch taken away from them by T-Mobile. And so while we may be seeing some consolidation in the industry, and while things maybe aren't going to get any worse, again, just looking at a growth perspective, both AT&T and Verizon are projected to continue their earnings decline through this year, and then going forward, their earnings performance is subpar, and I think, you know, they're talking about 1.5% growth annually. Then they're not even keeping up with inflation. Well, hey, that's it. As always, I appreciate the questions. Until next time, this is John Pugliano from Investable Wealth and the Wealth Standing Podcast.
Good stuff from John Pugliano, as always. I do want at this point to introduce myself, and actually you'll hear Nicole Sauce introduce me. So when I was down in Bastrop, John Bush asked me if I would be on a panel about entrepreneurship. I'm like, sure, I can add that into my talk. That's no problem. And I figured we'd all sit down, and we did. Well, like, we were like 10-15 minutes out from doing this, and they come to us and say, so each of you are going to talk for about 10 minutes about kind of your story and your take on this, and then we'll take questions. I got my notes app open on my phone, and I wrote down four little things, like one, two words each line. And it resulted in this talk that you're going to hear, and I did really like the way that it came out. Sometimes it's good to be put on the spot like that, and to have to come up with something quick. And so I'm going to give this to you, and I'll tell you that same thing I say in it to the audience. If you don't want to be an entrepreneur, you have some goals in your life that you want to achieve, and this philosophy is as valid for those as it is for starting and running an effective business.
Okay, I'd like to introduce one of my mentors who didn't know he was a mentor because he has a great podcast called The Survival Podcast, Jack Spirko. Tell us what you got.
Well, I want to start out with this. Who here, and I don't sell this service, who here would like a mentor for entrepreneurship? Stick your hand up, and don't be afraid. I'm not going to call on you. I'm not Nicole. Okay. Who here would like a mentor for anything? Okay, there's some liars. They won't put their hands up. They're afraid. I'm lying, and I'm not going to honor and not call on you. Most of you would. So I want you to know why. Nicole gets mentorship. Because all of my advice is things like, buy the beans. And then she goes and does something. She doesn't always do what I say, but she does something. She takes advice and she acts. If I have to talk to you for an hour, I am not your mentor. I'm your confidant. I'm your best friend. But I am not going to help you succeed. Entrepreneurship and basically getting what you want, whether it's through entrepreneurship or some other means, is a radically simple process. You set an objective, you figure out the steps to get to it, and then you fucking do it. That's it. And one of the things, you know, I speak at a lot of events, and I speak on entrepreneurship probably 10-15% of the time. It's not my favorite topic, even though I love it, but it's because it is the topic that people make the most excuses about. But what about the government? Status jujitsu. That's my advice. I don't know what it means. Figure it out. It's not hard. Status jujitsu. Turn their power apparatus back on them. Find a way around it. During a little breakout session I did yesterday, I talked about how we sold raw milk in West Virginia on a farm, and they said there's no way to do it. It cannot be done. Not in West Virginia. No way. Call it pet food. They have a law against that in West Virginia. They now have freedom for raw milk in West Virginia thanks to a gentleman named Roy Ramey, who's running for ag commissioner there now. Awesome dude. 27 years in the military. Retired colonel. Great guy. But at the time we were doing it, there's no way to do it. I said, is there anything that says we can't sell it as a soil amendment and tell people to keep it cold in their refrigerator so that it's fresh when they put it on the soil? And we could even put on there it's a violation of federal and state law to use this product in a manner inconsistent with its labeling. And we literally set it in front of the inspector and said, do something. He left. That's what he did. See, this is the mindset for entrepreneurship. My story, I came to Texas in 1993 after I got out of the Army. And my first opinion of Texas, don't worry, it changed, was this place sucks. Because I took my shitty $400 car. And I drove down here, and I broke down on 635 at rush hour. I was pushing the car slightly uphill across three lanes of traffic. Instead of helping me, people blew the horn. I'm like, what do you want me to do, break into a fucking Sprint? I'm pushing a car. It got better after that. I got a job making $5.90 an hour packing boxes in a warehouse. 3 years later, I was making six figures as a salesman in data communications, which 3 years before that, I didn't know anything about it. I ended up as a chief operations officer in a holding corporation about 15 years after that, working with a guy out of the UK named Neil Franklin. He's the only person in the world that ever won the Branson Award for entrepreneurship twice. I had made it. I was making lots of money, doing lots of things. One of the companies had 50 employees and 2,500 contractors. We could put a guy in the Philippines in 24 hours working on any legacy technology you were stuck with. I was fat, angry, and miserable. I got unhappy with what I was doing, so I decided I can do a podcast. So I did a podcast. Been doing that for 16 years now. People say you can't make money with a podcast. I'm not bragging. I'm just telling you the truth. You can make money doing anything you want. You just have to figure out how to monetize it. I make more money than most, like, primary care physicians doing a podcast. It's not bragging. It's just reality so that you understand what I'm about to tell you works. And that's I don't generally talk this way. But I'm going to give you four things. I'm going to be your mentor, like you said you wanted. If you don't want to be an entrepreneur, do something else with this information. Number one. If you say you can't do something, I will never talk to you again. Shut up and go away. You need to replace. And every time you hear yourself about to say it, and I don't care if it's going to be verbal where somebody else hears it or it's just in your head, you replace it with a simple question. How can I? That's it. I know you're looking for more. You don't get it. That's it. How can I? In between your ears, under your bone skull, is a 3-pound hunk of fat called your brain, is the most powerful supercomputer known to man. And if you program it right, it will give you answers. If you program it with crap, it will give you crap. and I can't do this thing either means you're looking for an excuse or you don't really want it. I don't really want it is okay. But ask how can I? And you might get answers you don't like. And they might be answers that require more sacrifice than you're willing to make. Okay, then you know. Then go find something else you want and say, how can I? Until you find something that when you look at that path, you go, I can not only see myself doing this, I can see myself loving this. I can see myself crushing this. If you haven't found it yet, you're not looking hard enough. If somebody tells me something, like, what do you serve at your workshops? We serve a lot of things. But one night we serve all sausages. I don't like sausage. You haven't tried enough. Do you eat beef? Yeah, here's a beef sausage. Eat that. It's beef. You like jalapenos? This one has jalapenos in it. Keep trying till you find what you're looking for. If you're not moving, you're not trying. Next, I'll give you one word, then I'll explain it. I'm not that much of a dick. Drill bit. Drill bit. Now, anybody that's heard this before, do not be afraid. Please put up your hand. You do not want a drill bit. You want a hole. Anybody ever hear that before? Either that one person in the back. What this means is so many people say, well, I want this thing. I need a drill bit. Well, what are you trying to do? I'm trying to make a hole in a thing. A lot of ways to get a hole. A nail, screw, blowtorch, truck through a wall. What kind of hole are you looking for, and what are you trying to do? This was something I learned from a mentor that I had very early in my life. Stop looking at the problem and start asking what you want the end result to be and how did you get there. The most powerful thing in the world for putting up a wall is the human mind. And I want you to think about this. You dream a dream, and you realize you're dreaming, so you know you're dreaming. Anybody ever have the experience like a lucid dream? You see a wall in your dream and you think, oh, this is cool as crap. I'm going to walk through the wall. Can't walk through the wall. Why not? It's your wall. You put it there. If that happens in your dream where you know that wall's fake, what do you think it is in your conscious mind when you think the wall's real? Walls are rules. Rules are made to be broken. Rules are made to be broken. And the smartest thing you can do is learn how to break the rule right in public. To where you can video yourself breaking the rules, send it to the government, and they can't do anything. Like selling milk. It's a soil amendment. And dare them to do something about it. Because I find most of the time when people say the government's in the way of their business, no, it's not. You just haven't gotten creative enough yet. You don't want a drill bit. You want a hole. Next, when Nicole was speaking today, and she talked about putting yourself first, a quote came to my mind from a gentleman named Richard Bach. I got a little condor in me, right? Illusions, Confessions of a Reluctant Messiah is a book that if you have not read it, you need to go read it. It was written, I think, in 71. Bach was a pilot. Illusions, Confessions of a Reluctant Messiah. Can't get into it. I don't have time. But there is a book in the book called The Messiah's Handbook. And it's cool. You just open it up and think about a thing, and whatever it says is your answer. And one of the times that the main character opens the book and looks at it, it says that every person who has ever mattered in the world was a divinely selfish person. We have been taught that selfish is bad. Now, selfish, like you have food and I want it, so I steal it, that's bad. Putting yourself first so you can accomplish the thing that you know helps other people is never bad. There's also a song that I thought of when I heard that. It was Cat Stevens. And it's called Fathers and Sons. Anybody ever hear that song? He sings both sides of it. I think it would have been much better if somebody else did the vocal so you really got it, that it was two people. But when the son sings, he said, from the time that I could talk, I was ordered to listen. I want you to listen to your internal dialogue, to that 3-pound computer in your head. It has every answer for you, and no one else has any answers for you when it comes to something as complex as building your life or a business. It can't. I can't give you a formula. I can't give you a standardized formula to build a business. It doesn't exist. It hasn't been invented yet because each one of you is an individual with individual challenges. Listen to yourself, except when you tell yourself you can't, and then you know what to do. Reprogram that shit. And then the last thing, Nicole mentioned this, the dash. I got that from a captain that I never served under in the military. I got to a new unit, 2 days after I got there, he was leaving and doing a changing of command ceremony where he spoke to his men after having run that company for, I think, 3 years. And it made me ache that I never got the pleasure of serving under that officer. And what he ended with is, don't waste your dash. When you die, they'll bury you, they'll inter you, they'll cremate you, they'll do whatever you or your family wishes. Somewhere, someplace, engraved or in print, it will say your name, born, died, in the middle is a hyphen. Men, that hyphen is you. If you could see it shortening, you wouldn't be waiting to act. I think a gift would be if every human being was born with a giant container, and in that container was these little marbles, these little glowing marbles, and that was your life force, and you knew how many you got, and every day if you didn't put one in your pocket, you would just die by like noon. And when we're young, we're not supposed to think too hard, so you probably, unless you were really unfortunate with very small amount, not really think about it. But as we age, you would see that level starting to go down. And then maybe you would take entrepreneurship or life coaching or whatever it is from a person that gives you instructions with three words at a time and waits to see if you do it. And if you can't find such a person, I know where you can find them. Go to your bathroom, look in the mirror. There they are. That's all I got, guys.
Thank you.
We'll pass it down.
And just one little error in there, and it's a significant error, really. On the timeline there, it was 6 years after I got that $5 an hour job that I was making six figures. It wasn't three, and that's why. And I said, and 3 years before that, right? So that's just how that worked out when being put on the spot. As I said, at one point I said a three when I should have six. So 6 years, and then 3 years from. 3 years prior to having that happen, I didn't even know anything about the industry that I ended up being successful in. Just try for accuracy, but sometimes in a live talk like that, you don't have time to back up and correct a misspeak. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and wrap up. I want to, again, thank everybody for tuning in this week. We will have a Friday flashback tomorrow. I don't know what that episode is going to be yet because I haven't put it together. A lot of times I have them done in advance, but I've slipped a little behind this week. I'll let you know why I slipped behind this week. I am really making progress now on the next course that will be coming out from homefoodsystems.com. This one will be on cover cropping for, you know, from garden size up to about market garden size stuff. Not really, broad acre level stuff. Everything at Home Food Systems is designed to help you produce food at home. I recorded the first lesson and did the final exam for that lesson yesterday. Got that over to Tom. He's building it out on the site. I would estimate that I should get that done by the end of the month. Before that, remember, homefoodsystems.com has two courses you can take right now. One is completely free. It's principle-based permaculture design. Take the course. See if it's right for you. That's why I did it. So there was a course, and you can see the difference in me teaching a course versus me doing a podcast and experience the whole thing. So it comes with certification. It comes with the exams. It comes with the study materials. It comes with everything a typical course would. I think if I charged $20 for it, no one would complain. Probably could charge 30. And the reason I did a principle-based design course is principles are geographically agnostic. They are climate agnostic. They don't care. It doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter what your rainfall levels are. Principles are principles. They're not tactics and techniques and strategies. They are the means by which you develop them for yourself, for your situation. We also have the bioreactor composting course there. Everybody that has taken that course has lauded, compliments on top of it. I've heard from so many people that are using it, that are building their own bioreactors. I've heard from people that have said, I've taken, you know, very expensive courses on soil science and things like that. I learned more in your course. It's only $40, $35 for MSB. So check out homefoodsystems.com. Remember, members support brigade members. Get that extra discount on the composting course off. and the MSB's on sale. So you can get the MSB for $35 a year right now with discount code TSPC. You can find that at thesurvivalpodcast.com and just click on members there. With that, I'll catch you guys next week with three live streams and everything else that we do in a week. But tomorrow it'll be a Friday flashback, and have a great week.
Bail you out, just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.